Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books Network. This is New Books in Sociology, and I'm Michael Johnston, the host of this episode. Today, I will be interviewing Dr. Anthony Harkins and Dr. Meredith McCarroll, both editors for The Appalachian Reckoning, A Region Response to Hillbilly Elegy, a book published by West Virginia University Press. Anthony Harkins is a professor of history at Western Kentucky University in Bowling Green, Kentucky, where he teaches courses in popular culture and 20th century United States history and American studies. He is also the author of Hillbilly, A Cultural History of an American Icon. And Dr. McCarroll is the director of writing and rhetoric at Bowdoin College, where she teaches courses in writing, American literature, and film. She is also the author of Unwhite, Appalachia Race and Film. Welcome to the show today, Dr. Harkins and Dr. McCarroll.
Thanks very much for having us.
So, to start off, could you tell us a bit more about how you came to write Appalachia Reckoning, A Region Response to Hillbilly Elegy?
Sure. I'll begin, and then Meredith can join in. So this is, at least in part, a response to J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy, which made an enormous splash across the country and was on bestseller lists for a long time. And I realized that, increasingly realized that there was a lot of concern about that book in the region in Appalachia. And so I proposed a panel for the Appalachian Studies Association conference 2 years ago on reactions to Hillbilly Elegy. And I looked around online and found people that had commented on it and written on it. And the panel went very well, and it was very well received and attended. And then West Virginia Press came and asked if we wanted to put a book together on that topic. And so that's at least a part of the process. But we always were intending to not just directly respond to J.D. Vance, but also to a broader question of how is Appalachia perceived and how do Appalachians perceive themselves, and partly directly in response to J.D. Vance, but much of it also extending beyond that.
Yeah, so my experience was driven by an interest to collect a lot of different perspectives, because part of what I felt was problematic about Hillbilly Elegy was the singular narrative that then shifted over and tried to speak on behalf of a large region. And so I was really interested in just collecting as many different perspectives on the Appalachian experience as possible. And that led to, you know, working with some really fantastic writers who are, you know, poets, fiction writers who are writing personal narratives, and then also led to a collaboration with a group of photographers that was really exciting. So together, these two different entry points kind of lead to a book that's really complex in the content and the subject, but also in the form.
So you're right that this project came out of J.D. Vance's book. How did the Appalachian experience that you discovered in this book from the compilation of different writings differ, and how is it similar to J.D. Vance's findings?
Meredith, you want to begin?
Sure. Well, I think it's some of the experiences that are included in our collection are similar to J.D. Vance's experience, because although his experience is, you know, certainly kind of maybe an extreme version of dealing with a family that is impoverished and is dealing with some abuse and addiction, that story is not completely unique. Lots of different people in Appalachia and across America have similar experiences of instability. So I think that one thing that I appreciate about the collection is that we have people who have similar backgrounds to J.D. Vance who are telling their own stories, sometimes drawing different conclusions, though. So part of the similarity would be this personal narrative that J.D. Vance talks about. And we also have contributors who are writing about the same spaces that J.D. Vance is writing about. So J.D. Vance grew up in Ohio and has ties to Appalachia and Kentucky with his grandparents. And so some of our contributors are speaking specifically about their own experiences in those same spaces. So there's certainly overlap geographically and in terms of some of the experiences of our contributors, I would say. Tony, do you want to talk about the ways that it's different?
You know, obviously much of his book is about his relationship to his family, a kind of love-hate relationship with different members. And I think that rings true for a lot of people in Appalachia as well. It's very, it's a region that's very much about family and kin and community. Where I think it differs dramatically is the diversity of experiences that we address. As Meredith said, I think the concern about J.D. Vance is the idea of the single story, and that his experience is a kind of universal one, and at least that's how many readers have taken it and continue to take it. I just saw this story about the Mind Minds coding program that was supposed to teach Appalachian community members how to code, computer code, and it's been a big fiasco. And in part, the people that promoted the program said that it's because of the attitudes of Appalachian people, and they pointed to J.D. Vance as a kind of example of, or sort of meta explanation for all of this. So what we tried very hard to do in our book was to not do that and to stress the multiplicity of the Appalachian experience and voices of people from various ages, various genders, various sexual identities, urban, rural, speaking to their own experiences and to show the range and the diversity of the place. And I think Appalachia often gets framed in very narrow, stereotypical ways. And it's not that some of those stereotypes aren't completely, or some of them do have some reality and truth, but there's much more diversity by race, by class, by gender than is often acknowledged. So that was one of the real emphasis of our book.
If I can, I was just thinking about one poem that's in the book by Linda Parsons called Tonglen for My Mother. And this is a poem where Parsons is reckoning with her own troubled relationship with her mother. And when she has talked at readings about this poem, I think it gets at your question, Michael, both in the ways that the Appalachian experience discovered in this book is similar to J.D. Vance's and also differs from it. So she's writing about this, you know, her own relationship with her mother who suffers from addiction and mental illness, and that she, like Vance, escaped to her grandparents in a very similar way. So she's drawing these clear connections. But in a bit that she has written that is published along with the poem, she says that her writing has inched, she says, my writing has inched me toward understanding peace and forgiveness. And I think this is a real point of difference between Vance's remembrance of his upbringing and what Linda Parsons is doing in that particular poem that's in Appalachian Reckoning, that she has moved to a place of peace and can appreciate what she gained from the people who helped raise her. And she at least is seeing Vance's remembering of his upbringing without the same sort of gratitude and perspective. So that's maybe, you know, two pages that are actually looking at the similarities and the differences between their experiences and J.D. Vance's.
And an interesting piece to this is the way that the rich history of Appalachia and how eclectic it is based on the stories told throughout this edited piece. Could you talk a little bit about how the rich history of Appalachian states has contributed to the wide perspectives that could come from people reflecting on, as they were throughout the different stories here, the experience they have had in Appalachia alongside the history and current experience of Appalachia?
Well, I would say that, oftentimes Appalachia gets, again, narrow-casted as simply a place of coal and coal miners. And that's been a huge part of the Appalachian story, but it's far, far less so today. And so I think we do have contributors who have family who have been coal miners and who live around coal mines. And the consequence of that, Ivy Brashear has a wonderful narrative about her mother basically, taking out a gun and trying to prevent the coal trucks from coming by her house at least one day because of all the dust and the soot and everything. I think coal is always part or is a central part of central Appalachia, but our contributors extend from, at least in terms of where they are now, from the northeast all the way down to the southeast, the entire range of the Appalachian region. And therefore they have a much broader range of experiences as well. And a number of them are academics, and so they have the experience of going away to college or going away to school or even being in school in the region, and the ways that as anyone who's at a university, in some ways you're somewhat removed from the broader community and then somewhat attached to it as well. So I think the diversity of the Appalachian history, and of course coal mining also, one important point to point out is coal mining also helped create much of the diversity of Appalachia because it brought in miners from all over the country, African Americans, Eastern Europeans, and that diversity, I think, is often erased in the conceptions of the region as basically all coal miners and all working class white, and usually all men, with few exceptions of thinking about women and their central role in the culture as well.
Yeah, and I think just too often when people outside of the region think about Appalachia, they picture, central Appalachian coal mining town that had boomed in the middle of the previous century and then has since busted. And I think that part of what is just an important truth about Appalachia is, as Tony was saying, the diversity in terms of geography, landscape, in addition to the people who are in the region. So it's a 13-state region that spans, all along the eastern seaboard almost. And so it looks very different in western North Carolina, where I grew up, than it does in Pennsylvania or West Virginia or the parts of Georgia that are Appalachian. And so the experiences are not only driven by whether you grew up in a city or a rural place, but there are also just all of these different subcultures within Appalachia. And part of that, I think, is important to capture in an authentic way by allowing people to kind of tell their own stories or through their own scholarship to explode this monolithic perspective that sometimes not only exists about Appalachia, but works really actively against Appalachia to simplify what it means to be Appalachian. And that's just worked in really powerful ways against Appalachia itself, this simplistic perspective.
And it's almost, a dual identity that is viewed in two different ways. There's stigma that is associated with being Appalachian or backcountry, whatever you want to, whatever stereotype we want to associate with it. But then there's also pride, right? There's pride associated with being Appalachian. And I think that stands out in your work here.
Absolutely. I think there is great pride and great sense of, I think one of the things that is not completely unique to Appalachia, but I think definitely shapes it, is a sense of relationship to place and to people. And that is very strongly held, and people know very well their ancestor stories and when they came to the region and how long they've been there. And they know very well the topography of the place in a way that I think a lot of people don't, know where the hollers are and where the river split and where, you know, this mountain was and hopefully is, but in some cases was because of mountaintop removal. And so I think that does tie to a sense of pride of place that is not as strongly held or not as widely shared, I think, outside the region, or at least particularly in urban or suburban settings.
Yeah. When you said the word duality, it made me think about the duality that I see has to do with perspectives of Appalachia. I think that Appalachia has been both romanticized as a place that is sort of, you know, of another time, and has also been demonized, or the people of Appalachia have been kind of demonized as somehow, you know, not modern enough. And when that gets played out sometimes in representations, it's, you know, Appalachian people can serve as the scapegoats, that they're somehow backward and, that they are not progressive in really important ways, or they're not a part of mainstream culture. So that duality, I think, is really important. But I think that the resistance to these outside perspectives, also to outside companies who have come in with extractive industries throughout the history of, you know, recent history of Appalachia, this resistance is part of what leads to a pride in Appalachia. I don't see a lot of, I think that there is an acknowledgement that in certain places where there's poverty and then the effects of poverty, leading to addiction and the opioid crisis that we see in Appalachia, as well as other impoverished places across the country, I think that there is a recognition that there is a difficulty in this moment, but I don't necessarily see it as, you know, like a dual feelings about being in Appalachia. I primarily see incredible pride in being Appalachian. Yes, that connection to land and knowledge of land and a closeness to a community, especially if you've been in the area for a long time. But I also have been thinking recently about how there's something that kind of creates a sense of pride because of this resistance that has called people to fight back and to claim their own voices around the ways that Appalachia has been depicted.
Yes, and some of the primary places I think you brought out, Meredith, in this book about ways in which you learned about Appalachia while you were from there. But then you're talking about an early movie that you had watched, and then the next experience being in college, and this book, being in college or in the workforce. But anyway, then this book being a reminder of that experience you had with film.
Yeah, I mean, the story I tell in the piece that's in Appalachian Reckoning has to do with, I grew up in the region. I definitely thought of myself as mountain. And when I went to college, I kind of understood what it meant to be Appalachian. And when I left home and went to Boston was when I really recognized that people had a perception of me based on, I mean, the thing that people always referenced was the movie Deliverance. And it was shocking to me that someone, you know, would have seen that movie and then, which is a horror film, and think like, oh, that must be what it's like to be from Appalachia. But, and even though it was, you know, sort of framed as a joke, I realized that there really was a deep misunderstanding of the region that I knew to be really complex and beautiful. And it was a really powerful myth of place.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And there are no movies short of just that one. There are several television shows that give a misrepresentation. I think of Moonshiners and things like that, but those are misrepresentations of the full picture, which I think is the beauty of this piece of work, is that it shows the different perspectives that people might not see in these different television series or movies. They would have a perverted view of Appalachia.
Absolutely, and of course that's nothing new. That's been going on for 200 years, and certainly since the middle of the 19th century. As Meredith says, the mix of romanticization and demonization is always been there in representations of Appalachia and the Appalachian people, usually often framed as hillbillies. And there's also a sort of perpetual fascination with it too, which has been kind of astounding to me. I really did think that it was going to sort of fade out as all these other negative ethnic and racial stereotypes have, at least to the extent that they're no longer acceptable. They're still used, but hillbilly has the idea of the hillbilly has just incredible legs, and it has a very mixed meaning. And of course, it matters if you're talking who's saying it and who's it being said to. But those representations in film, in television, in advertising, in music, in all manner of popular culture have been there for a very long time. And I do think Meredith's right that is part of what creates this sense of pride or this sense of resistance. And it's not just, you know, and it has longer extension than just Appalachia, because certainly it associates itself with all of Kentucky. Anytime all my students are constantly saying that, you know, I say, what are these stereotypes about Kentucky? And so many of them I've been struck by persist long after the representations in popular culture are kind of gone. Like the idea that they'd nobody has any teeth, and nobody has shoes. Those were very standard representations in the 30s and 40s, but they've really faded in popular culture, but that's still what people hold in their minds. So the power of those images are really strong. And I think one of my first concerns with the J.D. Vance book was the cover, because it represents a kind of dead and dying place, without any people, without any life. And those things, I think, still persist as well.
Yeah, and I think that those images, like Tony's talking about, of a dead and dying place or of a really backwards place, they're used to justify the erasure of people, the erasure of places. So it's not just a meaningless, harmless stereotype. They probably never are meaningless, harmless stereotypes, but certainly to portray a complex group of people from this enormous region in one really simplistic way is a way that companies can justify, extracting resources from places and destroying those places in various ways.
Right. And also, I think the ways that media doesn't see it as a problem, doesn't see it as problematic. Mm-hmm. And pays less attention to it, except in times of, except when it has political ramifications, which is another reason I think that J.D. Vance's book became such a phenomenon. Of course, was the Trump presidency, Trump election, and then presidency, and how it often gets framed as partially to blame, anyway, or maybe even largely to blame, is Appalachian voters who are voting against their own best interest, is how the argument goes. And again, hiding the or erasing the potential, anyway, for political diversity in the region, and also the ways that so many people in the region simply didn't participate. It wasn't necessarily they were pro-Trump, but they just saw the entire political processes in some ways broken and therefore, you know, not worthy of participating in, which is true of much of the country and not just Appalachian.
So when you went out to discover the different writings, and when you cast out an invitation for these, whether it be article or poem, how did you go about identifying which content to use for this book?
I think one of the things that I want to make sure that people understand, especially if they're kind of new to Appalachia or thinking about Appalachia, which, you know, I hope some of our readers are, coming to Appalachia for the first time and this is their introduction. But I think it's really important to recognize that what we're doing, in some ways, I imagine it as a snapshot of a moment. We didn't have to dig deep to find the contributors here. These writers have been doing this writing for a long time. These scholars have been doing this scholarship for a long time. There has been a rich history of both Appalachian fiction and poetry, Appalachian photography, and also scholarship around Appalachian studies for many years. So I just think that that's one important thing, is to to not cast us as heroes that went out and found all of these writers who were, you know, in their hollers somewhere, because these are all people who are part of a community of writers and thinkers and activists. And that is nothing new. What we were able to do, I think, is to look out and connect with people, some of whom we knew. A lot of the writers in the book were people that I had worked with in the past or that I had admired, people like Robert Guype, who is a novelist who I think is just, he's one of my favorite novelists out there. And so I wrote to him and just said, you know, it'd be a real honor to have your voice here. And poets like Jesse Graves, someone whose work I've read for years, that I just thought it would be amazing to have Jesse Graves and Robert Morgan to have their voices here. There's also a group of poets called the Afrolachian Poets, and this is a group that I've been following for about 15 years now, and it was kind of a no-brainer for me to reach out to some of those poets and ask them for contributions. So for me, it was, you know, the first round was really reaching out to people who have been doing this important work for a long time, who I've admired for a long time. And then we put out a call for papers, just asking, you know, because we wanted to make sure that it was open to other people that we had not yet connected with. And we got, you know, tons of great writers sharing their experiences, you know, telling their personal narratives and some poetry as well. And then I think that this Tony had a similar process with the following up on the Appalachian Studies Association panel. Is that right, Tony?
Yeah, exactly. I'm so glad you said all that, because that's exactly right. In many ways, the question was sort of who not to include as much as who to desperately try to find to include. But the panel was the impetus for the first part of the book, which is more scholarly, or at least more based on scholarship. But the panel was also just, you know, put together by just sort of looking who had been writing about hillbilly elegy in different ways. And some of those people I knew well, and others I didn't know at all. And some weren't from the region. Lisa Pruitt, who's a law professor at UC Davis, was from Arkansas, but had very similar kinds of experiences and a similar kind of space that she occupied socially. And so her writings on the relationship between race and class and the image of the hillbilly was a perfect fit. And then we also wanted to, at least that part about the part that directly responds to hillbilly elegy, we wanted to be sure that that all voices were heard. And I wanted to get some voices of people who wanted to see some strengths in hillbilly elegy, although maybe also recognizing its limitations. And so that took a little digging, but and we didn't want everybody to be from academia. And I think we've done a really strong job on that. We have social activists, we have community leaders, we have certainly a number of academics, but we have a number of different voices there as well. And the final part was the photography, adding photography to the project, and I think that's been a really enriching piece of it, because some of those voices, you know, some of those are ways to challenge some of the single story aspects of J.D. Vance in a very visceral way, to just simply show the variety of people and their experiences in the region. So I think bringing all of these together is part of what makes the sum greater than its parts.
To as another example of the way that this really was such a collaborative process, we had some poetry and photographs that were kind of curated, if you will, by Teresa Burris. And so her input was really important in helping broaden our perspective on the collection. And then we knew that we wanted, as Tony said, we wanted to have even more photographs. And for me, the photographs were, it was a little daunting to think about what images we should include, because images can be so powerful and have been used in such a forceful way to misrepresent the region or to simplify the representation of the region. And luckily, we knew about Roger May, who's a photographer from the area, who has a project called Looking at Appalachia, which is a collection of, it's kind of a crowdsourced photography project. It's a website, lookingatappalachia.com. And we worked with Roger and really just were able to select some of the images that we found to be really powerful or beautiful that would be important to include in Appalachian Reckoning. So I feel really indebted to the input of both Teresa early on and then Roger toward the end of making sure that we had the right kinds of images and voices included in the book.
Excellent. When approaching this, and as you started to process, started to develop, and started to edit this anthology, did you learn anything new about Appalachia that you had not known before?
Well, for me, it wasn't so much new as confirmation, but reaffirmation, I guess, maybe of the just incredible power of the voices of the region, the depth and the thoughtfulness of the scholarship and the beauty and power of the poetry and the narratives. It just reconfirmed to me the incredible richness of the cultural space and how so much of that gets erased in these very limited ways of thinking about it.
Yeah, I think I'm always learning something new about Appalachia. I mean, I would agree that it confirmed a lot of the things that Tony just said, but I feel like I'm always learning something new about Appalachia because Appalachia continues to evolve and change in really important ways. So I think that one of the things that was confirmed for me, but kind of exploded too in exciting ways was just how supportive this community of activists is and this community of scholars and writers. I've lived several different places and I've worked in, a couple of different fields and different colleges and universities. And it's striking to me how collaborative and supportive and connected this community of people is. And what I mean specifically here is not just that all of Appalachia is supportive, but the people who are really the advocates for Appalachia, who are sometimes farmers and sometimes are working on prison reform and sometimes are in classes teaching, K through 12, and sometimes are at universities doing research on history, all of these different entry points into Appalachia. What has really been exciting to me about the way that the collection came together was that I was able to just see a little bit deeper in each of these different areas to get to understand the complexity of some of these different areas, the scholarship, the work that goes into the fiction and the poetry, the community of photographers and the ways that they're connected, and then all of these activists who are working in different areas of interest or different entry points, but are all kind of working to protect a really complex place and don't need for that place to be any one thing. The ways that people are able to protect and preserve the complexity of Appalachia has been, I guess, a little bit surprising to me, just the depths of that and the complexity of that work.
Yeah, I would add one final thing is just the Appalachian diaspora and how many of these pieces spoke about thinking about one's identity outside of place or how one's sense of identity was created by the difference of being somewhere else. So much of the Appalachian experience has been one of having to migrate for work, but continually coming back for community and space. And I think those competing sort of ideas of being Appalachian and then being, how are you an Appalachian in the region and how are you one outside and where is your identity lie, has been one that comes up repeatedly in the book. And I think that's another aspect of the Appalachian story that was, you know, re-enhanced for me in reading these pieces.
One of the things that I thought of is W.E.B. Du Bois's double consciousness, being both Appalachian, but also trying to be a scholar or whatever it might be, and having both pull at each other, being in opposition to each other, not being quite enough of either.
I think that's a good analogy, a good connection. You know, it's also the idea that Appalachia for its history has often been thought of as kind of both in and not in America, that it's both kind of part of national trends and national experiences, but then it's also unique. And sometimes that uniqueness is framed as positive, as sort of maintaining a folk tradition and folk culture and unique places in a country which is increasingly becoming monotone and homogenous. But then other times it's seen as natively unique, you know, that it holds on to anti-progressive sentiments and attitudes. I don't know where I'm going with this. I think that mix of being both in and of a place and you know, seen as both positives and negatives, I think that also is part of the Appalachian experience that the book, that the contributors in the book wrestle with and try to articulate.
And I like using that idea of double consciousness, because part of what Du Bois is talking about is the way that one feels and the way that one is perceived, and recognizing that you are always being seen as something. And I think that definitely shows up throughout the book, this this realization that, you know, like to use my example, that I understood what it meant to be Appalachian. And then at a certain point, I understood what it meant to be seen as Appalachian. So where the power lies, whether it's in my own claiming of Appalachian identity, or does it lie in the, you know, does the power lie with the person who's seeing me and making assumptions about me? A lot of the pieces in the book are really wrestling with that idea of how do you claim, bring that together to have a full understanding of what it means to be Appalachian and also be seen as Appalachian. That to me has been one of the affirming things, both to read those other stories in the collection, but also those are the conversations I tend to have at readings that we've done. People coming up from the audience to talk about their own, you know, I have now, I think at every reading, had someone who's maybe in their late 60s or 70s tell me about the ways that they were taught that they had to lose their accent and that they never regained it. They never, you know, they never were able to make peace with what it meant to be Appalachian or to speak in an Appalachian accent. But that duality that you're talking about, that double consciousness, I think definitely shows up as people are trying to understand the ways that you can be Appalachian and also acknowledge the way, like what that means to other people.
So you've written several books on Appalachia and hillbilly culture. Have you continued on with your exploration of this topic, or where are you at now, Meredith and Tony, in terms of your current research?
Well, I'm not totally sure what my next step will be. I still feel like we're kind of in the middle of this and seeing how this plays out. I have been writing. One thing that this book kind of encouraged in me is leaning into the power of personal narrative. So I am working through an extended personal narrative that has to do with place and family. I am also potentially kind of returning to a project that had started years earlier on representations of Appalachian women in fiction. And trying to think about ways to collectively think about, this is just sort of a new idea, but thinking about ways to collectively understand the power of telling one's own story. And how does that work in, you know, I teach writing classes. And so thinking about the power of telling one's own story in a college writing class and recognizing the different things that influence the stories that you can tell and the ways that your stories really are unique. Those are some of the things that I'm kind of wrestling with currently.
Yeah, I agree with Meredith's earlier point, which is that we're still kind of working through the process of this book and the reactions to it and the broader public, and we've been very excited by how much attention it's getting and how much interest there is in it. I've written other works in the past on. I am, to be clear, I am not Appalachian. I've always looked at it as a from an outsider's perspective, from the idea of how is it perceived and how is it conceptualized on the national stage, and really even on the global stage. So I'm not sure what's next. The thing that I'm really interested in doing now is working on raising consciousness about the climate crisis. And it seems to me Appalachia is uniquely positioned in that conversation because there's been environmental activism in Appalachia for a very long time. It's very well conceived. And I think there's ways in which it can have lessons about how to change consciousness about environmental practices and move towards a more sustainability-based mindset. And I think that's what we desperately need in this country and world. And so one thing I've thought about is looking at that history and trying to see there in other places where we can find examples of how to do this, how to change people's mindsets and move from things which at one time seem completely unimaginable in terms of changing life, because why would you ever do that? And that's not what we're all about and whatever. But then at points in history that does change and people say, this is no longer acceptable. You know, we shouldn't have rivers catching on fire and, you know, we can do things about these things. And so that's the thing that I guess I'm starting to think about now in terms of my next project.
There's plenty of work to be done, and yeah. One publication at a time.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this has come to the end of our time together. I'm going to take a different approach since I've already asked the question of what are you working on now. Instead, today I would like to maybe discuss how you would advise a listener to approach this book, what you hope that they are to get out of this book when reading it.
Well, one of the things that we say in the introduction is that we want readers to understand that no one book can speak for Appalachia and that our book is no different, that no book can be the authoritative text on what it means to be Appalachian. So I would say, certainly, we hope that people would take a look at the book and make your way through it with an open mind and prepare to have some ideas challenged and prepare to hear a lot of different perspectives that don't always even agree with one another. But then I would hope, too, that this would just be kind of an entry point to doing deeper reading about the region, because there are so many important, fantastic writers who are digging in so many different ways to really complicate and advocate for Appalachia today.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. And I loved what Meredith said earlier about how, you know, we're hoping to get readers who really have not been, really know much at all about Appalachia. And so I hope one thing the book will do is promote further, you know, further interest in and further reading about the region. There's a very rich literature about its history and about its culture. And then I think the other thing is to think about the, just sort of recognize the benefits of such a wide approach to a topic or to an area. I think one of the great strengths of this book is its multiple, not just perspectives, but also forms, that we have poetry, that we have narrative, that we have scholarship, that we have photography, that we have humor, and we have anger. And all of that range, I think, gives for any place, not just Appalachia, but for any place, gives a more complete sort of notion of what a place is. And to maybe, therefore, not look at a book like Hillbilly Elegy and think it's kind of the definitive answer or the one only read that you need to do, and then you understand all about a region or a people. But to understand that it comes only through, you know, exposing yourself to a range of voices, and to recognize that that a range of people have, you know, very competing opinions. There's great beauty in our book, I think, and there's a lot of pain as well. And that mix of experiences is, you know, is not just the Appalachian story, but it's really the human story. And so to think about it as a small part of a much larger project of understanding, or at least getting a little better sense of the human experience, I think is, you know, maybe a little too dramatic at close, but I do think that our book can be part of that kind of exercise.
All right. Thank you, Meredith. Thank you, Tony, for joining me today. This is New Books in Sociology, a channel on New Books Network, and we look forward to having you on the show again with your next publication.
Thanks so much for having
us. Thank you.